So a lot of people ask me all the time, how is it that you do what you do being in your 40s? Well, it's a lot of hard work, but honestly, I got a lot of help. I've been going to Triple Threat Performance for my physical therapy needs for a few years now. I keep tearing this body down and they keep putting me back together again. And just recently, I joined their strength and conditioning program. And really, honestly, I don't think the mountains stand a chance this year. I feel stronger. I feel more flexible. I feel like I could go longer than I've ever had before in the past. So if you are in the Phoenix area and this sounds like something you might need or you want to up your game, check out Triple Threat Performance. That's ttpaz.com. ttpaz.com. Hey, I also want to give props to the Sneak Tech Sneak Boot. You heard me say it a million times. They're a game changer. And I'm not just saying it's not just lip service. They really are. They do what they're intended to do. And that is make a guy, woolly mammoth like myself, sound like a cat coming through the woods. And really just they're game changers. I think everybody should own a pair. It should be in your arsenal of weapons. And there is no other comparison out there. They're easy to put on, lightweight, easy to carry around with you. Don't take up a whole lot of weight and room in your backpack. It's almost foolish not to own a pair. So go check them out, Sneak Tech Sneak Boot.
Hi, welcome to the Interviews with the Hunting Masters, brought to you by Triple Threat Performance and the Sneak Tech Sneak Boot. Today, we're going to do a little campfire session with Braxton McCoy, and he is going to share with us his life experiences, basically, and how that's kind of translated into who he's become today. And I think it's an interesting story. So how's it going, man?
It's going good. It's going really good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So give us a little rundown about yourself and what you do. And
okay, yeah. I'm retired from the Army, and now in the spring and summer, I train horses here at home. And then in the fall, I guide elk and deer hunters and then some lion hunters. Try to get out hunting on my own as much as possible, but we stay pretty booked. I work up for Little Lost Outfitters up here in Idaho, so we stay pretty booked pretty heavily, but I get out when I can. It's usually from about the end of August till December. I'm kind of gone every day, but maybe 4 or 5 days. So
what part of Idaho?
We're about an hour and a half northwest of Idaho Falls.
Okay.
In the Little Lost River area, so
I'm gonna be over there by Idaho Falls myself in October.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Chasing good. Mule deer, or
both? I picked up a B tag and had a mule deer tag for elk and deer. So we'll see what happens. Cool. I've never gone there during a rifle season, and my last elk hunting experience is back in, I don't know, like 2003, 2004 up there. And I was hunting like in the Selway before it got really, really shitty. And my last hunt there in Idaho was a bear hunt. And I want to say, so I've been married 11 years. Probably 12 years ago. It was like the year before I got married. Oh, I was with my wife, but I wasn't married yet.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's definitely different now. That go hunt's kind of changed the whole
area.
There's a lot more traffic now than there used to be. But don't be surprised to find bulls bugling on that bee hunt, though.
Yeah.
Every year we see it. So.
That's what more and more people do. Actually, I was talking to Rocky Jacobson the other day, and he was telling me, you should probably get into some bugling bulls and stuff. It's just got to – and actually, Paul Metal, too, said the same thing.
Yeah. Stuff.
I'm not going to rely on it. I purposely picked areas that I felt like I'll be able to use my glass a lot more, so we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, it could go either way depending on the weather, obviously. So.
Well, cool, man. So, I don't want to like spoil it. I don't want to spoil the story. So,
Okay.
basically, you got a story from when you were in the military, and I'll let you. I'm gonna, let you elaborate on the whole thing. But the short side of it is, because of that crazy experience and what you've had to endure, what it kind of made you into who you are. I mean, all our experiences make us into who we are, but it's kind of a neat thing. So, and I think it's nice because it translates well to a lot of what guys achieve to be. So, I'm just gonna let you go for it, man.
Okay, yeah. Before we jump in, the one thing I would say that I think is most easily missed, unless you if you read my book, it's a little bit more elaborated in there. But when you tell the story, it's hard to pick up on. Well, I think the key principle is gratitude. It's that's the defining characteristic I would say of the story, and it's really easy to miss because it's kind of woven in there, but not so obvious. But not so obviously. When in January of 2006, I was a PSD guy, personal security detail guy, working in Ramadi, Iraq, which at that time was kind of just kicking off the battle of Ramadi, maybe a little bit before it really got going. But it's kind of the bloodiest era of the conflict in the bloodiest city. And we were assigned to guard this Marine element that was recruiting Iraqi civilians. And what they would do with these recruits is send them off to a high-speed training school in another country, and then they would bring them back and install them as like local police officers, Iraqi police officers. But we were there just protecting the Marine element and the Iraqi civilians. So my team was just, that was all we were supposed to be doing. And the location was this glass factory at the edge of town. Everybody knew it. It was one of the things that had kind of made the locals the most angry and most upset is we had to shut the operation of that glass factory down as the primary employer of the city.
And that's the name of your book, right? The Glass Factory.
It is,
Okay.
yep. And the reason we had to shut that thing down was it was just too close to our base. We just couldn't have civilians going in and out where they could actually reach people on our base with rifles, you know. So it was kind of a contentious area to begin with. And so we were there that morning, and it was actually the fourth day of what was supposed to be a 3-day mission. This kind of got extended because we had a higher turnout than was expected. I mean, this was Sunni Iraq that we really didn't think hardly anybody would show up, and literally over 1,000 people showed up. So it was kind of wild. But and that was the first red flag, by the way, too. It's just there were so many people there, and there just shouldn't have been. So we got there that morning, and all these guys were lined up outside of this gate, and we called up to the tactical operations center and said, "Hey, there's 1,000 guys here lined up. Something's not right, you know." And they just said, "Roger, you just continue mission. You got to get it done." And so we decided we were going to leave some of our guys in, and just me and Johnny, who's the alpha team leader guy, we left our teams inside, and just he and I and our interpreter went out and started asking questions. And while we were asking questions, these civilian guys, a semi truck crashed through what was our eastern perimeter. On the eastern side of our perimeter, we just had some machine gun nest set up like kind of little bunkers, and then some concertina wire across this road, and the guy just drove right through the concertina wire, and some soldiers and Marines opened fire on the truck, and that scattered civilians all over the place. And the guys were, I mean, just imagine like 1,000 people running around that you can't communicate directly with. You know, I don't speak Arabic, so it was pretty wild. And my interpreter, we couldn't even find him for a while. I don't know where he went. He kind of ran off. And anyway, me and Johnny were trying to get the crowd under control. And eventually, some of our dog handlers, some Marine dog handlers that we'd worked with before, came up and volunteered to come out there and help us out and try to get these guys sorted back out. And we were putting them into lines because during the Battle of Fallujah, a bunch of Iraqi civilians that were police officers or worked for the government in some way refused to support the Marine element that or the Marine Corps when they took the Battle of Fallujah. So we said we would never give those people a job again. We had to separate all these civilians into lines so that we would know who was who. So if they had a government ID we had to check it and make sure they weren't any of those people. And then if they didn't have a government ID, we had to put them in a separate line. So we had like these three categories. And the category that was the closest to the factory, the closest to the wall there, if I remember correctly, was people that had a government ID. And Sergeant Can was taking his dog Bruno up and down that line, and I was about 15 meters behind him at the head of line two. And his dog Bruno detected a explosive device on this guy and grabbed him by the arm. And all I heard was Bruno growling and shaking at this guy. And I look over and see he's got this dude's arm in his mouth and he's jerking on him. And I knew, like anybody would know, you knew for sure that that was not a good thing because the dogs are really well trained. They don't make
Right.
mistakes, you know. And then I saw Adam, I think, try to tackle the guy, and then it was just two big bright white flashes, and I woke up on my stomach, some meters away, and I actually thought we got hit by rockets, indirect fire, because we got hit by or we got attacked with those 2 days before, and I thought we'd just these were direct hits because there was two flashes. I thought it couldn't have been a vest, but it was just a malfunction in the vest. It went off in two pieces instead of one. But
Oh,
so the guy, yeah, it was a suicide bomber. And what they would do is they'd put the explosives on their chest, and then around them they would take like water bottles and fill them up with ball bearings and
right.
shards of glass and nails and all kinds of stuff. And so that would be
Maximize
the
shrapnel.
exactly those would become the projectiles. It's not just a lot like a claymore, really,
Right.
except for a lot more powerful. And so that thing went off, and that's what it hit me. And I woke up on my stomach and didn't really know exactly what was going on, but I looked down and I could see, all I could see was just a bunch of intestines and just, particulate and guts and all sorts of stuff and blood everywhere. And I honestly thought that I'd got blown in half.
Jesus.
It was this really weird, it was a totally surreal moment because I couldn't figure out how you could be alive but be in half. But you've always seen it in the movies and stuff.
Right,
It
right,
was
right.
just weird. And I was fumbling with this piece of what I now think was probably a pancreas, but it's hard to know for sure. It was like fumbling through it in my hands, trying to figure out if I could feel it in my left hand. And in the meantime, I was trying to get myself propped up, but I couldn't push up because my right arm was busted. All the bones of my right hand were broken. My right radius and ulna were broken. Actually, my right humerus didn't break. And then I tried to get up and I couldn't push up. And then on my left side, my left humerus was fractured. So I couldn't do hardly anything with that side at all. But I finally got my right elbow underneath and was kind of propped up looking at all this stuff. And about then, I could hear Johnny yelling my name. And he would start pulling. I didn't know at the time, but I had three different bodies on top of me, Iraqi civilian bodies. And he pulled those three off. And when the last one went, the gut pile went with it. And then I could see the top of my hips finally. So I knew I at least, had hips. But my legs were, it was just, they hurt a lot. So I knew something was going on down there. And when he rolled me over, to try to start addressing, wounds and stuff, I had my legs didn't like the one. They ended up having to roll the bottom half of my legs over after because the bones were broken so bad in my femurs that my legs twisted almost all the way around my body,
Oof.
so my feet were almost upside down. And it was a crazy experience. I had my left femur was broken in three spots, and my left hip in two places, and my right femur in two places, and my right hip in one, and my left tibia was fractured. And I had a spinal fracture and small shrapnel wounds in my face and neck, and my right median nerve in my hand was transected. And I mean, I was banged up pretty good. And I actually, we just found out I got hit in the heart so hard by some shrapnel that I have a scar on my heart. That's a different story altogether. But so anyway, they got me rolled over and started patching wounds. And just for the sake of brevity, they started patching wounds up and got me to a helicopter and tried to ship me to Balad to get surgery. And I was losing so much blood that they had to stop in TQ to Quantum from Ramadi, which is only like 15 miles or something. It's not that far. Maybe it's 30 miles. anyway, it's not far, but particularly in a helicopter. We
Right.
had to stop and get more blood there. And then from TQ, we didn't make it to Balad. We had to stop in Fallujah, and they did the first surgery in Fallujah. And my blood pressure was so low that they didn't want to give me morphine or anything like that.
Right.
So I had a local anesthetics at best on everything. I didn't have any painkillers, and they had to split my quads from my hip to my knee on both sides with a razor blade. Because I had what they call compartment syndrome, so all that
Yep.
swelling in there was
Pressing
closing
on
off
everything.
the up, and
Yeah.
it was essentially killing my legs from the inside out. So they had to open that up to relieve the pressure so that the swelling had a place to go. So it didn't actually like let the pus out or anything. It just gave the muscles somewhere to go outside the IT band. At least that's my understanding of it. And I'm sure some doctors out there are like, oh, that doesn't have any idea what was going on. But that's my understanding of it.
Right.
And then they shipped me to Balad. And once I was in Balad, I was stable enough that they put me out. And I don't remember a whole bunch after that besides my flight to Germany and then waking up in Landstuhl. And they put these cages on my legs called external fixators that kind of hold the bones together for the flight to Walter Reed, which is in DC. Then they flew me to DC and I spent like several months in ICU. And then they moved me to a neuro ward. And when I was in ICU, I got gangrene. I almost
Oof.
lost my legs then. And every doctor told me, they just kept reiterating, you're so lucky that they didn't amputate, because apparently it was like a 50-50 deal. They took a chance, I guess, and didn't amputate my legs, which, just thank God, I guess. And I got gangrene in the hospital, and then I had a nurse overdose me once in the hospital. It was completely by accident, I guess. And then, well, I hope. And then,
Yeah, right.
right.
She
And
wasn't
then, yeah,
Iraqi,
no.
was she?
Yeah. So, and then I had a pulmonary embolism,
Oh, Jesus.
and that collapsed my left lung. And they did this emergency surgery, and they had to install this IVC filter, inferior vena cava filters that looked like an umbrella without a skirt on it. And it went down in my vein, and it was designed to break up blood
Right.
clots. And that thing was in there for 12 years. I actually just got it out a couple of months ago, and I spent a decade having doctors tell me they couldn't remove it. And then I found a guy at the University of Utah that ripped it out. It's pretty crazy. But when I was in the hospital, the surgeons anyway, were saying that it was entirely possible that I was never going to walk again. And if I was able to walk again, it was going to be 18 months to 2 years kind of thing. And then I had a young, high-speed surgeon guy get assigned to my team. And I don't know if it's just the arrogance of youth or what, but he thought that I could walk. And he said, well, you're going to have to do it before your muscles atrophy too much, which is probably good thinking with all those holes in there. I have something like 30 holes from my knees to my hip. Some of them are through and through, and most of them actually are through and through. So it was good thinking on his behalf. But anyway, so he got me my physical therapist's name was Solomon. He actually played with the New York Giants on the Phil Sims Giants team.
Oh, wow.
He was a neat dude. He
I'm a
helped me get
Giants fan.
up and are you really?
Yeah.
Yeah. The guy was so cool. He's my favorite guy at the hospital probably. They helped me get up and I had to learn how to walk again, and all four limbs were still broken. My arms were still broken. I had this big, huge brace thing on my right side, and I would just put that on the, like those things that I don't know what you call them, but it looks like the things you hold on to get into a swimming pool, except for
Yeah.
15 feet long, like parallel
Right.
bars. I'll just,
Like a parallel bar for
Olympics or
the
whatever.
Olympics. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just like that.
A walker, yeah.
And so I had to just put that cast thing on the right side on that, and then on the left side I just had this, I don't know, it was like kind of a soft cast on my left humerus. And I just walked up and down that thing, and started with like the first step was a huge deal, and then we just kind of got going. And then I'd taken a few steps, but I hadn't really walked at all. I knew it was possible. They'd given me two canes that were they had like those 4 feet on the bottom of them.
Right.
And that was to help me get from my wheelchair to the bathroom. They weren't really for like walking, I guess, but we went to, with the help of this guy that is a Vietnam veteran that I knew that came and visited me. And with his help, we snuck out of the hospital on a Sunday to go to Walter Reed, or excuse me, to Arlington. I just wanted to go. I don't know. I just wanted to go. And so we went to Arlington, and I wanted to go see Sergeant Cann's grave. Is when Sergeant Cann got killed by the suicide bomber. And so, anyway, I got to Arlington, and there's a, there's the, it's hard to explain, and I don't know that it, maybe everybody would feel exactly the same in Arlington or not, but there's like an energy to that place that's different than anywhere I've ever been. You know, it's just a reverence that, and I'm sure there's a million reasons for it, but it really did seem every time I go that there's almost some kind of meta thing going on there. But past these signs, and there's this place called McClellan's Gate, and on it's got this poem on it called "The Bivouac of the Dead," and I'd probably butcher it if I recited it now, but it's something like, "On fame's eternal camping grounds, their silent tents are spread, and glory guards with solemn round the bivouac of the dead. Rest on embalmed and sainted dead, dear is the blood you gave. No impious footsteps here shall tread upon the herbage of your grave." Something like that. And for some reason, I just felt like I wanted to walk to Adam's grave. I felt it would be dishonorable in some sense for me to let somebody wheel me to this guy's grave when he had given his life for, you know, us. Just wanted to be respectful. So I got out of my chair and walked all the way to his grave. It's about, you know, a mile or half a mile or something, but it felt like 20.
My bet.
I mean, I was bleeding all over the place, you know, and surgical scars, and I still had holes that had wads of gauze in them and stuff. And got to his grave, and I just wept. I just wept like a child, and it was not just the loss of you know, a brother or something. I mean, that was part of it, but it was that I had laid there in that hospital for so long, feeling sorry for myself, and just being whiny and needy and all this. And when I got to his grave, I just realized that there wasn't a soul among those 250,000 people that wouldn't trade places with me. And it was just the, I felt there's no way that I could continue on being whiny, little, you know, just a wretch. I felt, you know, I couldn't continue. I just felt I couldn't live like that, knowing that these guys had made a sacrifice that I couldn't even, you know, anything I ever did paled in comparison to what they've done. And that changed my perspective on the world, I think, forever. It wasn't just getting wounded and getting through all this stuff and everyone calling you a hero and all this, like that was all bullshit to me. I still don't like any of that. But having a quasi-religious experience, realizing not just the sanctity of life, but the true value of that sacrifice, changed the way that I view everything. And
I can
I've
imagine.
almost, in some sense, made it like my life's mission to hopefully try to convince people. It's almost impossible, but to try to get them to understand, you know, the value of life, you know, and what that sacrifice really means. And it's, of course, in my line of work, it was soldiers and Marines, but there are other people, you know, firemen and EMTs and all these different people. And that, you know, in some sense, even the guy that's a construction worker that works until his body's destroyed just to pay his family's bills his entire life. That's another one of these sacrifices that I think our country, not just our country, but the world, sort of at large, has forgotten about. Like, it was just, the value's gone. You know, like, people don't understand it anymore. And I think that's part of that's among the biggest problems we have in our culture right now. We're like disassociated from that. And that, we spent however many thousand, depending on your worldview, however many thousands of years becoming the people that we are now. And that was a part of it. And we all understood it. That's where all these rituals and things come from. And now, it seems like we just write it off like it's nothing, you know? I think that's something that we've gotta, because if you can't value that, then how can you be grateful for what you have? And if you're not grateful in your day-to-day life, then you'll never be fulfilled. You know, there is no fulfillment without gratitude. You know, it's like you're Sisyphus, you know, you're just pushing the freaking rock up the hill every day and then starting over. So, anyway, sorry for that tirade there.
No, please. I honestly, I love it because and of course I've never been through anything nowhere near as traumatic or tough as you, but I went through a time and it was more like mental, emotional, whatever, and I found myself, cursing my life out all the time, and I was like, "Fuck my life, screw this, I nothing there," and I'm a negative Nelly to begin with, and a while back, a friend of mine told me, about being grateful and thinking about being grateful. So, like, I put a reminder on my phone every morning at 6 a.m. And it pops up and says grateful, and I have to say to myself at least one thing that I'm grateful for. And it's kind of like it's anchored me, like it really has. It's helped me out a bunch because I've had a lot of ups and downs, especially financially, whatever. I've had businesses and gone bankrupt and this and that and just been all over the map. And there's a lot of times I got to grab a hold of myself and be like, dude, it could be a freaking lot worse. You got a lot of shit going good going for you. Stop freaking bitching about it.
Yeah, right.
I complain way too much still, but I know that I never let myself go down that rabbit hole now because of that, because it's just like, I find taking a moment and thinking about the things that are good in your life, even if everything's not what you want it to be. It's okay to
Right.
have ambition to be what, get from here to here, but
Yes.
don't knock what you already have, basically, I guess. So.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, and as far as athletics, your coach will always tell you that satisfaction is the death knell of ambition, and I think that that's true, but you have to be able to delineate, you still got to be grateful for the great things that you have. And that there's a clarity that comes with that, like you're obviously it's a hunting show, like one of the most difficult parts, particularly on an elk hunt. I don't know about difficult. It's not really that difficult for me, but one of the things that separates, I would say, successful, and I'm sure you'd agree, but successful, particularly archery elk hunters from the rest of the pack, is that when you hear that bull bugle 45 minutes before it gets dark, you're not wondering whether you're going to go try to kill that bull. Like you're, it's just not even a question. You'll hike all the way back at in the dark till 3 o'clock in the morning if you have to, but you're going to try to kill that bull because that opportunity is presenting itself. But people that have not accepted the element of suffering in life, they tend to fall apart when plan A falls apart, and they don't even recognize plan B when it's there. Sometimes plan B is I was hiking back and a bull bugled from the way I just came, and it's like, well, shit, I gotta go kill that one now. Like instead of just being grateful that the bull bugled, even if it was the opposite direction of where they were going, they're still caught up in the failure of plan A,
Oh, that's an awesome way to put it. For
So,
sure.
yeah,
So,
and
go ahead. No.
no,
I'm
that's it.
curious to see how, I was going to ask you, how long How long was it before you actually went over there? Because I kind of maybe I lost it. Maybe you said it and I lost the timeline a little bit when you were walking to your friend's grave.
That was about 3 months, four, 3 or 4 months into the hospital, somewhere right in there.
Okay.
And I never really got back in a wheelchair after that, but I certainly was not just like, walking
Yeah,
through an
yeah, yeah.
airport. I mean, it was still, I'd hate to oversell what I was doing. It was still, to go 100 yards was no easy task. I'd have to stop several times. And, but I grinded at that for probably 3 or 4 years. And then I finally, probably 2 years in, I was down to one cane, a regular old wood canes. And then probably another 6, 8 months, maybe even a year after that, then I had no canes and I can still walk quite a ways. And even then, it wasn't like walking a mile, I don't think. And then 4 or 5 years in, then I could kind of walk a mile or two. And then I grew up boxing and I had a, for some reason, I could still, I didn't have footwork like a boxer by any means. I'd be in trouble, but I could still catch mitts for guys. I started doing that, and that really helped a lot. I got a lot more stable. This was about 6 years later. I did that for a few years, and then one day I was playing. What's that?
So you don't realize it, but you build proprioception by doing that, and that's all the little balance muscles, all the little
Oh,
intrinsic muscles. Yeah.
okay.
That
Yeah,
was that is
well,
actually great therapy. That's
really?
that, oh yeah. I used to be a physical therapist, so
Oh, okay. Yeah, so you know exactly what's going on. Well, I didn't. It worked because one day I was out catching ground balls for this. I was dating this girl that had a kid, and I was just out fielding ground balls for him a little bit. And, I could take a step or two to the left or right, but I couldn't really. There was definitely no explosiveness there or anything. We
Right.
were out there and it was a hot day, and I was pitching to him and just, like I say, kind of feeling them as they come back. And he kind of ripped one to my glove hand side, and I took about 5 steps, and if I was like, holy shit, I think I could run. It was just this weird moment. I'd spent 8 years feeling like I could never ever run, and then I had that one little, it just felt like I could do it. So I dropped my glove and just jogged around the bases, and it was the craziest feeling. I did one set of like 90-foot, base to base, sort of half-hearted sprint, and I texted a few of my friends that night from the military, and one guy was living about 4 hours north of me, Johnny, and I texted him and I was like, dude, I want to try to run a mile, because I told him the story or whatever. And so about 4 days later, we got together at this point. He was running like triathlons and shit by then. So he's, running a mile with him didn't even warm up his ankles, But we linked up, and I ran my first mile with him, and that was crazy. That was about 3 or 4 years ago. And I just kept running after that. And then I went and did a hike in Hawaii on Mauna Kea. And I did a bunch of training for that and a lot of running, 2 mile runs, and then eventually 4 mile runs. And then I hiked Mauna Kea and I started mountain hunting again. It was crazy. It just like all of a sudden, I spent 8 years just with this thing in my head that it was never going to happen, and just to try to be grateful for what I could do. And then I had this one moment where I figured out that I'd been wrong, And that helped. That definitely helped with perception too, because I'd gotten on my feet because I ignored doctors, but then I started listening to stuff that I shouldn't have been listening to. I didn't take the lesson away from that that I should have taken, and then I had this one moment of clarity. It was definitely just dumbass luck, really, that it happened. And now, I've run a duathlon and I'm competitive in endurance races, and not just there. I have a chance to win every one I get in, and
Awesome.
that's like, I for sure nobody thought I would ever get there. In fact, when we were moving, I found a letter that talked about when I was going through the medical evaluation board to retire from the army. Talked about how I was probably never going to be able to play baseball with my kids or softball with my daughter or anything like that. And now I can do any of that stuff. It's not pain
Amazing.
free. That's the
Oh
other
yeah.
thing. It sucks. Every bit of it sucks, but it sucks in a way that's, I don't know, it's painful. It doesn't suck. It's wrong to say it sucks. It's just painful. Pain is just like a thing that I just have to accept that, and then I can live, So it's worth it. It's a trade-off. It's like you gotta pay a toll one way or the other, And for me, it's pain, and it's just not that big of a deal.
Hey guys, just a real quick break. Pardon the interruption. I want to talk to you about becoming a patron of the show. It's super easy. You just go to the Interviews with the Hunting Masters on my Podbean account, and at the top right-hand corner, you'll see a green button that says "Become a Patron." Or if you're using the Podbean app, it's right there. Just click on the button, "Become a Patron," from any of the episodes. I really go out of my way not to bombard you with a bunch of ads and clutter up the, clutter up the episodes. I really like to keep it as educational and as valuable as possible. I'd like to add to that value by adding some bonus episodes that are going to be just for the patrons only. I'm going to release a few that are strictly for those of you who have contributed to the podcast. It really goes a long way, and I want to say it again that even a dollar a month, pledging a dollar a month, $12 a year, may not seem like a whole lot, but it means the world to me. It helps me take care of the cost of producing this show, and I really appreciate it, and I'd appreciate you guys. Thanks for listening, and let's get back to this episode.
Yeah. It's crazy what you can adapt to live with, like
It really is.
pain becomes like a friend. When it's gone, you're like, wait a second.
It's true. And everybody keeps telling me that I'm gonna, when I'm in my 50s and 60s, and that's when it's really gonna set in, and I'm gonna be messed up and all that. But they've been saying shit to me for, 12
Yeah.
years now, and it's all been wrong. So, I mean, I'll just stay as mobile as I can, and
There you go.
I'll see what happens. So,
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome, man. So how long have you been guiding now for?
just a few years, 3, 4 years, something like that. I mean, I've been hunting elk and deer my whole life, but
Right.
had that span there where it was legitimately 8 years where I was just worthless. I was pretty much a road hunter. Not that if you have a legitimate disability, you have to be a road hunter. I'm not.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that. But if you're able-bodied, then I think you're a wussy, and you should evaluate yourself. But so it's only been, 5 years or so that I've been able to do it. And it's actually the way I got the job guiding was I got a phone call from Sergeant Major Les Chapman, who's kind of he was a Command Sergeant Major, MACSAW guy, Special Forces guy in Vietnam. And I didn't know him from Adam when he called me, but he called me on my cell phone. And he said, "Hey, I've got a wounded warrior hunt I want to send you on." And I told him that I thought I felt there was definitely people that would be better candidates that had, less hunting experience and stuff, and they could have got more out of it than me. But he said, "Nope, I'm not asking you, I'm telling you." And so I said, "Okay," and I went up,
Nice.
and this guy is he's like, if you ever get a chance to look, he's like a legitimate real deal hero guy, Distinguished Service Cross, like 9 Purple Hearts and 7 Silver Stars. I mean, this guy's a legend, so not a person that you really want to say no to if you're a military guy anyway. So I came up and met him, and the guy that was putting the hunt on, his name was Doc Levitt, Glenn Levitt, and he's a doctor up here that owned like a semi-pro football team, and they invited me, and we went to their game, and then I went on this bear hunt.
Nice.
And the guy that was the outfitter on the bear hunt is now one of my best friends. He's like, "If you ever wanted a job guiding elk hunters, I'd hire you in a heartbeat," because we were, talking elk the whole time. And I said, "All right." And I went and worked for him that year. And, now I live up here by him. So
Nice.
it's like, yeah.
That's
Yeah.
awesome.
It was pretty cool. It's crazy the way life kind of works out sometimes, Going on a hunt, I didn't even really, not that I didn't want to go, I wanted to go,
Yeah.
but. And then all of a sudden I worked for the guy, So pretty cool.
Oh,
And
yeah.
actually, we work out together every morning. I mean, we're close friends, so pretty cool.
That's awesome, man. Well, if you could, if you got time, share with I want you to share with me your most memorable haunting story. Could be a guiding
Actually,
one too, I don't care.
probably my most memorable story was in Hawaii, and it was because it's so ridiculous. But I got to be pals with this dude. I went fishing with him the day before, and he was a deckhand on this deep sea boat. And he's like, "Bro, I'll take you hunting tomorrow if you want to go." And I had my bow, and I'd been up mouflon hunting, and he's like, "Let's go shoot some goats." And I said, "All right." So I jumped in with him, and it was the day I hiked Mauna Kea. So I had thermals on because the top of Mauna Kea is all snow,
Right.
in February. So I still had thermals on and like my Sitka gear and all this stuff. And I get down there and we're hunting goats, basically on the beach. So it's like 85 degrees and sunny. And
Jesus.
so we come driving down the road and he's like, "Oh, there's some goats right there." So I just grabbed my rangefinder and my bow and jumped out of the truck. I didn't have anything. I just my brain stopped working for a minute. And so I go chasing these goats and I shoot one and I hit it just a little bit too far back. And he starts going off through this lava rock. It's like this big black lava flow. So I'm tracking little spots of blood through this lava rock, trying to find this freaking goat. And oh, for at first I missed him the first time I shot over him.
Okay.
I couldn't figure out how I missed him, because I didn't know how big they were,
Yeah,
So
yeah,
I
yeah.
shot over this thing, and I thought it was like a deer. I thought, how the hell did I miss that? 67 yards. I'm like, that's a slam dunk at a buck or something for me, at that time. And anyway, so I'm tracking this thing, and I finally find it down in this hole. But by the time I get there, I've got my pants tied around the top of my head, and I'm in my freaking underwear, no shirt, like all my gear shoved into my pants like a backpack, hanging off because I'm just floating my butt off in that lava rock. I get down there and I realize I don't even have a knife or anything, so I got to freaking skin this thing with a broadhead. And so I opened it up. Anyway, just long story short, then to meet up with my buddy Jawa, he said, "Just come down to the beach and I'll meet you." So I get down there and there's like this mesquite stuff. I don't know what it's called, but it looks like mesquite, big old thorns on it and everything.
Yeah, I've
So
seen
I
it.
come through there in my freaking underwear with no shirt on, tattoos all over the place. And it's like scratching me, that mesquite stuff. So I picked up that goat and held it over my head like a little shield and just pushed myself through the mesquite. And when I popped out, it was like the most pristine beach you've ever seen. It's like beautiful, white sand and blue water. And
Nice.
there's this family out there picking up seashells, and I come busting out of there,
They
this bloody ass goat in my hand and
probably
my
freaked out. They
underwear.
thought they were in a horror movie.
It was so ridiculous. But yeah, no, not none of the elk I killed or deer I've ever killed were as fun as that. That was the funniest thing I think I've ever had happen on a hunt. But
Nice. Did you throw that
yeah,
thing on a spit and roast it on the beach?
and he so we went to leave. And we were gonna go back to the apartment that I was staying in and cook it up. And he's like, "Holy shit, man, I forgot I have a court date today." He got some marijuana ticket or something.
Oh,
And so he
Jesus.
had to go to court. So he just dropped it at his friend's and dropped me off on the road. And my buddy came and picked me up by the airport on the road because he had to go to the other side of the island. So I
Okay.
was just kind of by the Kona airport where he dropped me off. So that day in general was just ridiculous, the whole thing. And he's talking to me. He's like, "Bro, what do you think will happen if I miss this court date?" I'm like, "You're gonna go to jail?" I don't
Yeah,
know. Like, you kind of got to go
probably.
to that, So, anyway,
Man.
Hawaii is different, though, right? It's a different place.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like United States,
Yep.
but not the United States.
It's really not, huh? It feels like a different country. It really
Yeah.
does.
Yeah.
Yep.
Crazy. I've been there a couple of times. I went recently, was it last year? Actually, yeah, I went last year with my wife for the first time. I gotta go back. I want to go axis deer hunting there, man.
Me too.
I've been fishing there, but I haven't actually hunted in Hawaii, and I wanted to. I just the two times that I've been there, one was for a wedding, so I really didn't have the opportunity to do it. And when I went with my wife, she's like, "No, you're not hunting." I'm like, "All right, all right." But if we come back again, I am. So that's the deal I have with her. So next time we go, we're gonna do a little axis deer hunting.
That'll be awesome, man. That I don't know how Lanai is, but the Big Island, the only thing about the Big Island sucks is the time zone. The times that you can hunt are really kind of schizo. Like you can't stay overnight anywhere, and so it's like that was the hardest part of the whole thing was coordinating a time that you could go, and get out.
I've
But
heard that, but I think I want to do Lanai.
yeah.
I had a friend of mine invite me, and he lives there half the year, and he lives half the year in California. But so I don't know if I can hook it up with him. At least he knows the ins and outs of it. I'll do it for sure.
For
Oh,
sure.
excuse me.
That would be an amazing hunt too. It would be so fun.
It looks cool. My buddy Matt did it. I think was it last year? I got it. I think it was last year he did it, and he said he had a great time. He got one, so I'd like to
Yeah,
try
was
it.
it bow hunting, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
I've killed a couple axis deer, but one in Florida and two in Texas, but it's not the same.
Right. Yeah, probably not as wild as out there, right?
No, I don't. Yeah, the one in Florida and one of the ones in Texas were overfeeders. That wasn't
Okay.
hunting. Yeah,
Right.
and then I did one spot and stalk in Texas. That was the only one that I was like, oh, that felt like I
Was were
did
they
something.
pretty jumpy
Oh yeah, super
in
jumpy.
Texas? Yeah. So it's
Yeah.
just like what they say in Hawaii then.
Yeah, super jumpy. So,
Yep.
well, cool, man. So I want to help you. You mentioned something to me earlier before we actually hit record on the podcast. You saw my coos deer behind me, and you said it's a bucket list. I want to extend an invitation to you. If you want to come coos deer hunting, I'd be happy to take you. I think that would make me feel it would make me feel good to help out somebody who's been through what you've been through, a guy that's sacrificed a lot for his country.
Oh.
And so if you want to ever come down, you hit me up, man. I'll take you hunting for sure, bow or rifle.
All right. I might actually take you up on that, so I hope you're serious.
Oh, I'm serious.
Okay.
I don't make suggestions if I'm not, or I don't make empty promises.
All right.
I tell that to people all the time. What you just said, when they, oh yeah, you got to come to this. I'm like, listen, I'm the kind of guy that says, you invite me to go somewhere and it's not someplace I've ever been before, I'm coming.
Heck yeah.
I almost always do if it's within reach, for sure. So,
Yeah.
but
Absolutely.
well, awesome. I want to thank you for coming on. Where can our where can our listeners pick up the book? Is it on Amazon or?
Yeah, it is on Amazon. You can get it from the hardcovers are only on my website, but the paperbacks are you can get paperbacks on Amazon.
Okay.
I
What's your
make more
website?
money off my website, BraxtonMcCoy.com. BraxtonMcCoy.com. But you can buy it from Amazon, doesn't matter. But I do
Nah,
make
hell
more
yeah.
off my website, so that's
Go
good.
to the website, guys. Don't go to Amazon.
And we yeah, and we autograph everything on the that comes from the website now. And that's it's one of those it's re I it weirds me out to be signing books, but people want it, so we just
That's
do it
cool.
by default. So yeah, I'm not
Yeah.
big on autograph and stuff, but people seem to like it. So if you want your property defaced, go to the website
It's
and
kind of a weird feeling, huh? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I still weirds me out. I mean, I've been doing this since early 2000, and when people approach me, like, oh, you're John Stallone. I mean, can I get your autograph? I'm like,
Yeah.
dude, I'm just me, you know?
It
But yeah.
is really weird. I totally agree with you.
Yeah. Well, that's cool, man. Well, thank you again for coming on, and I'll put the I will put your website in the show notes, so if anybody wants to go check that out and buy a book, make your life a little bit easier. Yeah, cool, man.
Cool. Thanks, man. I really appreciate it. Okay,
All right, have a good day.
you too. We'll see you.
Bye.
Hey guys, want to stay connected with the podcast? Check out my blog, johnstallone.me. That's www.johnstallone.me. And you could go on there. On the top right-hand corner, there's a little subscribe box. Quickly put in an email address, hit subscribe, and boom, you're done. There's a lot of great information on there. a lot of posts that go hand in hand with the podcast that we do, plus gear reviews, plus we have the signature t-shirts on there, the I Eat Fast Food t-shirts, and the Tuesday Coosday shirts. It's a really good way to stay connected with the podcast. And thanks for listening.